My lords, ladies and gentlemen, colleagues, students, welcome to you all. The university is greatly indebted to Lord Britton, former Vice President of the European Commission, for the creation of the Alcuin Lectureship. He himself delivered the first Alcuin Lecture 10 years ago, and we're very pleased indeed to welcome Lord Britton back to listen to another speaker this evening. On Thursday evening, the political leaders of the European Union's 27 nations will meet, and we will learn the names of those chosen to be the first permanent president of the European Council and the first High Representative for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy. We have heard much speculation and denials about possible British candidates. But the story of waxing and waning British influence in European affairs is a long one. And if the negotiations had taken place in 800 AD, Alcuin of York would have been a good bet. He was an advisor to the Emperor Charlemagne, and his qualities as statesman, scholar, preacher, and logician would seem useful personal attributes for the incumbents of contemporary European positions. Last year, our Alcuin lecturer was the then European Commissioner for Trade, Mr. Peter Mandelson. Since then, he has accumulated British honours and titles beyond counting. I cannot promise that Cambridge's Alcuin Lecture is always such an effective career springboard, but our Alcuin Lecturer this evening doesn't want for titles or for platforms from which to speak or to be in need of a career. Shirley Williams is a member of the House of Lords and a Privy Councillor. She is a governor of the Ditchley Foundation, a board member of the Nuclear Threat Initiative in Washington, D.C., and a trustee of the Century Foundation in New York and the Institute for Public Policy Research here in London. She is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations International Advisory Committee and serves on several other boards, including the Moscow School of Political Studies and the International Committee on Nuclear Non-Proliferation and Disarmament. She has been active in academia alongside politics and is now Professor Emerita of Electoral Politics at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. In June this year, the University of Cambridge became just the latest to award her an honorary doctorate. Shirley Williams' authoritative voice is heard regularly in political commentary on the radio and television, but still, the younger members of this audience may benefit from a little contemporary history. Our speaker's political career began in 1964 with election as a Labour Member of Parliament. In 1971, she was appointed Shadow Home Secretary. And as Labour entered government in 1974, she became Secretary of State for Prices and Consumer Protection, a position she compares to King Canute trying to order back the tide of inflation. In the reshuffle caused by Roy Jenkins' appointment as President of the European Commission in 1976, she became Secretary of State for Education and Science. 3 years later, Labour was out of power and Margaret Thatcher's Conservatives were in. And in 1981, Shirley Williams was out of the Labour Party, disillusioned with the influence of the far left wing and determined to set out the positive case for the European community, which the Labour left considered part of a capitalist conspiracy. With Bill Rogers, David Owen, and soon Roy Jenkins, she formed a new party, the Social Democratic Party, and was elected in the Merseyside constituency of Crosby as its first MP. She supported the merger of the SDP with the Liberal Party in 1987 to form the Liberal Democrats, now firmly established in British politics. And she served as the leader of the Lib Dems in the House of Lords from 2001 to 2004. Professor Williams is an uncompromising promoter of European integration. In her recently published autobiography, Climbing the Bookshelves, she has this to say about the European Union. Quote, "The most radical experiment in cooperation between nation states has been crippled by national jealousies and limited to economic supranationalism, the single market. It is still unable to move forward to political or military interdependence, or even to agree on the Lisbon Treaty, a collection of modest steps towards greater integration. Consequently, Europe, in political matters, punches far below its weight." Now today, as we know, the Lisbon Treaty has squeaked through ratification in just the past few weeks, and Professor Williams this evening will help us to imagine what comes next and the consequences for European politics. Professor Williams has generously agreed to take a few questions after her lecture, and it is a pleasant feature of Alcuin lectures that they are followed by a reception. I hope that you will all stay afterwards in the atrium for further discussion and libations. Professor Williams' topical topic this evening is the future of the European Union after the Lisbon Treaty. Professor Williams.
Well, first of all, thank you, Vice-Chancellor, for a very gracious introduction. Let me also say right away that I'm delighted that Leon Britton himself and his wife and family are here. And I'd like to say, if I may, just a few words in order to embarrass him through. He's Lord Britton of Spennythorne. Leon comes from a whole group of distinguished Conservatives who were among the leading people making the Europe of the 1970s and 1980s. And he himself, of course, became a commissioner at the end of that period. That group of people, many of whom actually attended the University of Cambridge, were among the serious architects and builders of the European Union. And I'd like in particular to pay a debt of tribute to Leon, because despite the fact that during the period that he had been commissioner, when he came back into British politics, the attitudes within his own party had become more markedly Eurosceptic than they were earlier on, he made it absolutely clear that, in his view, the Treaty of Lisbon was badly needed, but did not actually justify a referendum. And in doing that, he took a courageous stand, and one that I think was extremely important. We can talk more about that later. Let me also say that he came from a group of distinguished Britons who made a very, I think, marked contribution to Europe, the group of men and women who became commissioners. Whether one thinks about Lord Britton, or about Lord Patton, or even more recently, to take the most recent example, Lord Kinnock and then Cathy Ashton, who was the former leader of the House of Lords, these commissioners have made a major contribution to Europe, and one that I think has been extremely important. In many ways, they have been more than punching their weight, and therefore this is, an issue which I hope one can engage them in, as well as the rest of us, in discussing the way we ought to go. And as the Vice-Chancellor said, I'm an unregenerate European, and in order to save time and trouble, I'll explain very quickly why I am, although much of my own career, much of my own life has actually been spent in the United States. It's partly for that reason that I am now a very strong European. Well, I think one has to say, first and foremost, that the major issue, I believe, facing us at the present time is the almost complete asymmetry of the challenges that confront us and the governmental structure that responds to it. The challenges that confront us in the most acute way are almost all of them global or major regional challenges. For example, as we well know, in the next couple of weeks, we will see a major attendance of various important people at Copenhagen. many people leading non-governmental organisations, many people who are deeply concerned and worried about climate change, many people who already be feeling quite frustrated and quite depressed by seeing the best chance in the immediate future of a serious treaty about climate change slipping away, hopefully not forever, but still missing the timetable, and that's terribly important when you get people committed to a timetable. And that is obviously an issue that cannot be resolved by any one country on its own, even a country on the scale of China or the United States. A second major issue, which is very close to my mind at the present time, is the issue of nuclear proliferation. We can see, because of people moving towards nuclear power in a civil field, driven in part by fear of climate change, in part by energy prices, in part by a concern for energy self-dependence, we can see already a major expansion of civil nuclear power, something like 25 countries, which don't currently have any, in the next 30 to 40 years, and beyond that, a whole lot more. We reckon at the moment that the number of nuclear power stations will be trebled by the middle of this century. So that's also a huge issue. It's an absolute illusion to think that any one country can deal with that issue on its own. The most radical answer to the problem of nuclear proliferation, of civil nuclear proliferation, is frankly the internationalization of the whole process, from the feeding in of feedstock, uranium, plutonium, and so forth, all the way through to dealing with waste at the other end. That massive step forward, a revolutionary change in our whole political and economic structure, is very hard to avoid if one wants to actually have a system that really, truly works globally. And so again, we are on the edge of something very close to a revolution in the way in which we deal with the problems that confront us. A third problem, the growing inequities in the world, with the position of those countries which are, for example, in Africa and in parts of Southeast Asia, actually worsening steadily in relative terms, and the issue of how one deals with that. We've got, of course, the UN Millennium Goals, which are more or less, mostly less, being met. But beyond that lies the huge problem of massive poverty and the ways in which we attempt to deal with it. Again, a global issue which has to have a global answer. The tragedy of all this is that most of us in the democratic developed world are still adhering to a course of response that rests upon the validity and the legitimacy of national governments. So you have this extraordinary asymmetry, global challenges, national responses, and then you're into the business of trying to knit together those numerous national responses to try to be in time to deal with the global challenges. That's, in a sense, what lies at the heart of my conviction, that we have to find supranational ways of dealing with these issues, and that the EU, for all its faults, and undoubtedly it has some, I wouldn't argue that it hasn't, is one of the very few models in the world, political and economic models, that is actually on a scale and has a shape that makes it a feasible way of dealing and answering and responding to these challenges. Having said that, all that, let me go back whence I came. The story of Britain's relationship to the European community is the story of one missed opportunity after the other. And the reason, I believe, for those missed opportunities are essentially Britain's self-image of itself, which is very much out of line with the historic truth and out of line, above all, with our potential. Let me go back just for a moment to the beginning. In 1946, when I was a schoolgirl, my father took me to the great Zurich meeting at which Winston Churchill, gave a famous speech, the Zurich speech, in which he outlined the need for a united Europe. He presented it very much in terms of a Europe that would be led by the United Kingdom, but also by France, a Europe which would respond to the needs of a devastated continent, and he called in the most magisterial Churchillian terms for a United States of Europe, something which our friends in UKIP and other related Eurosceptic parties do their very best to forget. It was followed, and it's very important to say this, by probably the most successful response of cooperation between the United States and Europe, which was the Marshall Plan. And out of the Marshall Plan came the earliest sinews of cross-European cooperation and coordination. Just to remind you, because none of you were there, with very few exceptions, at the time that the OECD, or rather more precisely, the OEC and the Marshall Plan were born, among other things that what it did was to have a brilliant system of peer group monitoring of the way in which other countries use their aid from the Marshall Plan, of a bringing together of European countries to invent and create a plan for spending that money in the most effective way, of people being taken in groups to see the way in which the United States had built up productivity and management in ways that might or might not be copied and followed within Europe. But the key thing about it was that it took the concept of cooperation between nation states as far as it could possibly go. And it was very, very successful. Unquestionably, within 20 years, that's even being generous, maybe 15, you could say that the continent of Europe had largely begun the process of rebuilding itself, of growing again, of finding self-confidence, of beginning to develop the outlines and the cooperation that eventually led to the astonishing proposal for a coal and steel community in 1950. A little story about that. That was the very beginning of it all, the coal and steel community. Why, you might ask, a coal and steel community? When I would be talking today about a nuclear and an energy community. Well, the answer, of course, was that even then, as late as 1950, coal and steel were still seen as the ultimate resources that were needed to mount a conventional war. They had been the ingredients that had created, in many years in Europe, repeated civil wars, coal and steel. And therefore, to control coal and steel at a supranational level was to, in effect, go a long way to control the possibility of warfare itself. Let me tell you a little story about that time. An invitation in 1950 came to the United Kingdom government. It was expressed in very generous and very optimistic terms. It invited the United Kingdom to come to the discussions about coal and steel. In effect, it almost invited us to take the lead in those discussions. The invitation was taken to Ernest Bevin, who was by that time the heavily ailing but outstanding foreign secretary of this country. Ernest Bevin had been, it's an amazing story, not time to tell it all, but he started life as a carter, a man moving goods and services with a horse and wagon in Somerset, then grew up through trade union movement to become Minister of Labour in much of the war, and finally emerged amazingly as Foreign Secretary in the Attlee government after the war. He was not an internationalist, he had not travelled a great deal, but he had a great deal of common sense, and he had an astonishing loyalty from the Foreign and Commonwealth Office towards him personally. The letter came to Ernest Bevin, who by that time was in a hospital bed. And I know about this story because it was told to me at first hand by his junior minister, Kenneth Younger, who had had a distinguished military career and was now a junior minister at the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. Ernest Bevin summoned him and Hector McNeill, his other junior minister, to his bedside, and he showed them the invitation. And he said to them both, "What do you think my response should be?" And the answer from Hector McNeill was, politely, in effect, "Well, Foreign Secretary, you're much more senior than I am. I'm sure that you will give the best possible reply." Kenneth Younger, who had become a very strong European supporter because of his wartime experience, rather like Ted Heath because of his, replied by saying, "Foreign Secretary, you should accept." And Bevin looked at him with a certain kind of contempt and said, "Don't try to swim, young man, until you've been able to jump in the deep end." Now, that dismissal was very characteristic of the way that the United Kingdom handled these issues at that time. And one of the most senior civil servants in the negotiation wrote back to the Foreign Office to say, "This won't work, and if it does, it'll break down within a matter of a few months." I don't remember the exact wording, but we have corroboration to my audience. There was the most clear dismissal. "These people can't possibly get together. They've got long enmities. They can't obviously find common cause." Well, I won't bore you with the whole history, but in 1956, something very much the same happened when the attempt at Messina was made to actually build a common market. And it has actually characterised to a very great extent, with a few exceptions, the level of government reaction of the United Kingdom to the whole idea of the European Community and later of the European Union. Tragically, after 1975, when we did hold an in-and-out referendum in this country, and both Lord Britton and I were very much involved at the time in that massive national debate, when the solution led to a 3-2 majority, incidentally, in every region of the United Kingdom except for the Shetlands, some thought in that, there was a substantial majority for becoming a member, staying in, word used, but remaining as a member of the European Union, or European Community then. And that was, in a sense, an invitation, a moment of decision for the United Kingdom, where unquestionably, I believe, the last opportunity to take a seriously leading part in shaping it passed by. Because immediately after that period, after 1975, with that victory ringing in our ears, there was almost complete failure by the government of the day, which was a Labour government under Harold Wilson and then later under Jim Callaghan, to follow up with the essential attempt to try to involve the British people in an educational information campaign which would enable all of them to take part in what would then be the building of the European Union. It didn't happen. It didn't happen then, and it's never happened since, with the result that for the lack of any kind of effective attempt to inform, educate, discuss, consult, learn, most of the British people today, even if they are pro-European, feel themselves astonishingly unconnected from Brussels and everything that it does, and from the European Union as a whole. There is still the fond belief that this country has a different role. That different role is the role of being part of a special relationship with the United States. But of course, as David Cameron, the leader of the Conservative Party today, and his colleagues discovered, the trouble is that's not what the United States wants. What the United States wants is not a special relationship with one medium-sized European country, even one with which they have long cultural connections and some sympathy and some sentiment. They want an effective partner with effective power and strength, which can work with them closely to address the problems that are now confronting and troubling the world. That was always true. It was even true in John Kennedy's day, but it's become steadily more true through the 60s and 70s, until we get to George Bush II, who wasn't sure he wanted a special relationship really, except on issues like the Iraq War. He was essentially, had become something of a unilateralist rather than a multilateralist. So you then get this situation, therefore, at least in my view, where the United Kingdom continues with something of an illusion, both about its past and about its future. That illusion takes it out of close connections and relations with Europe. It's always looking for ways in which it can remove itself from political and defence and security integration and stick only to the economic integration that flows from the single market. Let's go back a minute. How did that come about? The answer is that when Jacques Delors became the chairman of the Commission, he was looking for ways in which he could find a way forward that would carry Britain with it. He was keen to maintain and indeed strengthen relationship with Britain, but he had Mrs. Thatcher as our Prime Minister with a very strong English nationalist commitment. I use the word English advisedly because it didn't extend to a very great extent to Scotland or Wales, but certainly to England. Now, she saw herself clearly as also maintaining, importantly, the special relationship she had perhaps the best relationship of a British Prime Minister with an American president since the end of the Second World War, and that was her relationship with Ronald Reagan. They thought and saw doctrinally very closely together. Delors offered a range of options for the way forward, and of that range of options in the early 1980s, some were unacceptable to Britain, like a closer integration of defence and security. Some were considered to be far too soon and far too dangerous, like moving towards adopting the euro, where there were strong objections on the ground of the role of sterling, and the fact that if we joined the euro, the issues of interest rates, incidentally no longer very important, but at that time seemed to be very important, would in fact no longer be in British hands, and indeed issues revolving around the influence and effectively attitudes of the city. The one that did appeal to Mrs. Thatcher, as we all know, was the single market. And the paradox was that the single market, which she quite enthusiastically supported, probably carried integration further in the economic field than anybody could have guessed or anticipated. All over the economic field now, we see the concept of the single market within the broad outlines of a liberal market system, leading all the time onwards to closer and closer integration about standards, about safety, about trading, and now, of course, increasingly also about the integration of services. So that's been held up at the moment in Brussels by conflicts. Well, let me go from that point then. Mrs. Thatcher contributing probably the single greatest push forward of any prime minister after the referendum, of anybody, any leading figure in the United Kingdom. And come to where we are now to respond to the Vice-Chancellor's question. We are now in a very difficult and very significant situation. That situation is made up of three things, and I'll talk briefly about each of them. It's made up partly of a more difficult and more complex relationship with Russia and with its associates, and was true in the days of the Cold War. The Cold War glued us together. It glued together Western Europe, the United States, the United Kingdom. And in a way, therefore, the fact that we didn't have the underpinnings that were needed to make a success of the European Union itself was not noticed very much, because the pressures and the threats and the challenges up until 1989 of Russia were sufficient to keep us together and to make it the first necessity of our decisions about security and defence. At the end of that period, there was, of course, the tragedy, that's the only word for it, of the succession wars in Yugoslavia. There were two great challenges at the end of the Cold War. One of those challenges was the unity of Germany. The other great challenge was the succession in Yugoslavia to what was a disintegrating state. The first one went surprisingly well. There were difficulties. There was often some discrimination among West Germans towards East Germans. The East Germans were not altogether easy to absorb, and their economy was very hard to absorb. And of course, the Chancellor of Germany at the time, Helmut Schmidt, made an astonishingly generous gesture to enable that unification to go ahead without too much difficulty. And that astonishingly generous gesture was to make the Ostmark and the German mark equivalent in value. The Ostmark was not worth anything like as much as the German Westmark, but they were brought together in order to give a kind of bonus to Eastern Europe to enable it to see its way to unification and to do so in a harmonious state of mind. It's actually taken a long time culturally, I think right up till now, to complete the unification of Germany, but the political attitudes were enlightened, tolerant, and thoughtful, not least on the West German side. And I pay due credit for that, because it would have been very easy to have done what Mrs. Thatcher at one time feared, to look at East Germany as a sort of Bismarckian challenge which should be dealt with by hard power. It isn't what happened. Now, the other thing to say about Germany after unification, the biggest country in the European Union, the biggest economy in the European Union, was that it showed an astonishing degree of restraint and of modesty. There was no attempt to try to bring big Germany forward as the future leader of Europe. And that's rather surprising, because obviously the temptation must have been there, that the wisdom, and I think it really was wisdom, of German leaders at the time meant that that never happened, despite the fact that in this country there were deep fears expressed, not least by the British Foreign Office, by the Prime Minister, by 10 Downing Street, about the possible repercussions of the unification of Germany. The story on Yugoslavia was tragically profoundly different. Again, not time to go into it in detail, but you may remember that when the Yugoslav Federation began to break up, some years after the death of Tito, one of the first influences that came to bear on what had been Yugoslavia was, oddly enough, the astonishing cultural attractions of the memories of the Habsburg Empire. It was the countries that were most Habsburgian, that were most Western in that sense, that were most like the culture of the Habsburg Empire, who wanted to make the transition and made it relatively easily. Slovenia, for example, a very successful member, by the by, of the European Union right up till now, moved away in 1991, very quickly after the fall of the Berlin Wall, and became an independent state. In the Briony Accords, that independence was recognized by all the other countries involved, and there was no fighting. However, as the dissolution of Yugoslavia moved on, the countries which were ethnically very dissimilar from the Serbian support that was at that time behind Milosevic, the president of the Yugoslav Federation, you began to get into more and more choppy and difficult waters. Croatia, culturally, religiously, very different from Serbia, was one of the most difficult ones. There was, as you know, a substantial long war over the issue of Croatia, with, first of all, ethnic cleansing out of Serbs living in Krajina and elsewhere in the Croatian areas, and then a turn back when it was the Croats themselves that suffered from the response of the Serb government, or the, more precisely, the Yugoslav government, but essentially being reduced to something of a rump. For reasons of time, I won't go into that in detail, except to say that I'm afraid the war in Croatia, and even more the subsequent wars in Bosnia-Herzegovina, persuaded the United States that Europe was not up to serious political global responsibilities. It was, in many ways, a sad failure. You may remember that, unfortunately, in 1994, I think it was 94, just before the massacre at Srebrenica of the Muslim men and boys, that Jacques Pousse, then the chairman, the president of Luxembourg and president of the Council of Ministers, announced that this was the year of Europe. So it might have been, but Europe had none of the resources, none of the ability in the military field, none of the capacity of creating common positions that would have enabled it to seize the opportunity presented by the disintegration of Yugoslavia and make out of it an example of what Europe together could do. It wasn't like that at all. And what made it even worse was that we accepted France and Britain, the main countries that carried troops into Bosnia-Herzegovina. They turned it into, in many ways, an issue where the accepted rules of engagement were simply, frankly, absurd. The rules of engagement said, and they were imposed by, well, not imposed, they were agreed between the United Nations and the European Union, that the military who were out there under the French or British flag could not intervene to protect civilians. Their job was simply to protect humanitarian supplies coming into Bosnia-Herzegovina, but not to actually deal with the threat that were continually levied at them. And so you got what I can only describe as the near obscenity of the siege of Sarajevo, one of the world's most tolerant and cultured cities, by a Serb army, which was mostly armed with old mortars and old cannons from the Second World War, which frankly could have been pushed out of the way relatively easily if the European military national powers had made up their minds so to do. It all ended, as we know, in a rather cobbled together Dayton Agreement imposed on Bosnia-Herzegovina and on the Serb government and on the Croats by Dick Holbrooke of the United States. And that brought the wars to a rather jagged and pretty brutal end. Leaping all the way from that to now, to today, we face a whole set of different challenges, and we do so with a very nascent, indeed infantile, structure of security and defence structures, systems. We've got the systems now at the Seville Council of Ministers 4 years ago, more than that, 2002, there was established the beginnings of the structure, the mechanical structure, if you like, of a defence and security system. We set up a European Defence Agency. We set up a European Defence Committee. We set up, a bit later, a European Defence University. All of these structures were put in place. There was one fundamental problem, and it's still there. And it's one of those I want to ask throughout to you to think about and come back with your own comments. The fundamental problem is that we now have the machinery. We now have a clear sense of the need. I'll come back to that in just a minute. What we haven't got yet is any clear common sense of what the purpose of a European foreign policy ought to be. Therefore, let me first look at the sense of what it is to have this structure in place, though not quite certain what to do with. We were very tempted, the European Union, to be, as it were, what Joe Nye of Harvard would have called soft power people. And the soft power is undoubtedly impressive. When you look at what the European Union is doing, supporting the United Nations in places like the Democratic Republic of the Congo or even Sudan, when you look at the kinds of things it's doing in places like Aceh in Indonesia, putting together, in Timor as well, putting together countries which have been, or states which have been devastated and are in disarray by support for what they are needing in terms of governance, in terms of courts, in terms of rules of law, you can only be impressed. It is a very fine story, but a very limited one. It also has one great characteristic, which I think is innovatory and brilliant, and that is that in the European security and defence policy, tiny though it is, one has for the first time a joined-up civilian and military combination, a pairing, if you like, which means that you don't have what even today we have in Afghanistan. Troops go in, troops go out, and leave behind them a country which is unchanged, which has not had its opportunity to build up institutions, not necessarily democracy, but unquestionably the rule of law, unquestionably methods against corruption, and so forth. So this innovation of the European Union is very impressive. It's unique, I think, in the world, bringing together the civil and the military in a combination. But the same trouble applies. We know now how to go into Aceh. We know how to go even into the dreadful situation of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. We're beginning to develop a real partnership with the United Nations so that the desperate attempts to try to maintain peacekeeping should in future be strongly supported by the European Union, which has the money and has the concept deeply in mind. The European Union hates to go against the United Nations, as the Iraq war showed perhaps more clearly than anything else. The problem is still the one about a common position in the most difficult areas. And let me just mention three of those and then turn for just a moment to bringing together some of the things that we need to think about in the next few years. The first of those is, of course, Russia. The relationship between the European Union and Russia is a fraught one. It was much easier when it was all the Cold War and one knew where the borders began and the borders ended. We don't know anymore. We know that the near abroad, as Russia calls Ukraine, Georgia, and some of the Caucasian states, is something that Russia regards as semi-sacred. It gets deeply concerned if people move in and try to influence those countries around the edge of Russia. One shouldn't forget that Russia is in many ways a deeply insecure country with a strong memory of the invasions and the offences it has suffered in the hands of history. You've also got in Russia, and this is a very important point, in relationship to the United States, a profound suspicion, made much deeper particularly by the ballistic missile defences proposed for Poland and the Czech Republic by the George Bush administration back in the mid-1990s, back in the mid-2000s, you've got a very deep sense of what is the American administration up to. What are its intentions? What are its goals? Now, I think the American administration, in the shape of President Obama and those around him, have gone some way to persuade Russia that he is genuinely a different kind of administration than that of Mr. Bush before him. That his main intention is to try to work with Russia and not just to work against her. But consider for a moment how much turns upon this. Obama's main goal, according to what he said during the campaign and subsequently, was to deal with the threat facing the world, particularly of out-of-control levels of armaments in the nuclear field, by reviving the disarmament structure that had been created partly by his father, George Bush the First, by George Bush's father, by recreating that in the Obama administration as a new architecture of disarmament. And he was very brave in what he said. He talked about leading towards the abolition of nuclear weapons. The first step in that, which is absolutely crucial and the easiest, is a major reduction in the arsenals held by Russia and the United States. Those arsenals, Russia and the United States together, constitute 95% of all the nuclear weapons in the world. China, India, Pakistan, Britain, France, and you can chuck in Israel if you like as well, and possibly Iran and North Korea, have between them well under 2,000 nuclear weapons. The thousands are those held by the United States and Russia, estimated to be at least 25,000, apart from those that have been withdrawn and put into various forms of storage. Therefore, to get going on this ambitious idea about nuclear disarmament, it is absolutely essential to start with the momentum that only Russia and the United States together can give to it. And that is currently what is being discussed in Moscow, the idea of a replacement for the START Treaty, which, by the by, dies out at the end of this month, with a new START Treaty, which will then have penciled into it the first stages of a reduction. That reduction may happen. It'll be relatively modest, probably only 40 or 50%, but then that's a lot if you've not gone anywhere in the last 10 years, towards the goal of a much reduced set of nuclear arsenals. The problems are two. Some part of what Russia's very suspicious of has been in part corrected. The proposal for ballistic missile defense in Poland and the Czech Republic has now largely been shelved and put on one side. But the problem is this one. Many people in Europe fail to recognize that the United States is almost unique in having a truly independent legislature, not one which is in effect under the control of the executive, as ours is, but one which is genuinely independent. We may come to regret that, because the independent Senate, which has to ratify the treaty before it can come into force, is now passing through a period of extreme partisanship because of the rows over health. Obama, in the last first year of his presidency, has sadly already lost a great deal of political room and influence because the Republicans have, with a few exceptions, virtually walked out on his proposal on health and are indicating clearly within the Senate that they're not in a mood to cooperate. When the Arsenal Treaty comes forward, the big question will be whether the Senate is willing to ratify it. And people who think in this country it all depends on how strong Obama's leadership is should think again. It's nothing like as simple as that. The second one in this area, which would follow the Treaty on Arsenals, is the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. The United States has never ratified it, though Bill Clinton signed it at the end of his presidency, knowing perfectly well that he had no intention of trying to get it through the Senate because he didn't want to waste any of his political capital on doing that. This time, it is inescapable. Inescapable because there's a whole line of countries. Russia's already ratified it, but there's a line after that of China, of India, of Pakistan, and so on, ready to sign if the United States does, but highly unlikely to do so if she doesn't. And so the whole great Obama vision in the nuclear field will come to a pretty dead stop if the president considers it so unlikely that he can pass it that he will put it to the Senate at all. There is currently a letter from Senator Lugar, the leading Republican internationalist, to the president to say that at the moment he has not got the votes needed to pass the comprehensive nuclear test ban treaty. And the worry is that by the midterm elections in 2010, Obama's position may not be strengthened, but actually somewhat weakened. The second big issue I want to mention in passing is the issue of relationships between the United States and the European Union. And you may think that that looks rather calm. Well, there's one big problem. That problem is exemplified this very day, by the announcement by the Palestinians that they propose to ask the EU to support them in a bid to United Nations Security Council for them to ask for United Nations recognition of an independent Palestine made up of the West Bank and of what is remains of Gaza. Now, in some ways, the Palestinians have got good reasons on their side. They have been negotiating for 18 years and getting just about nowhere. And in the course of that negotiation, there has been a movement of what is sometimes called the position on the ground, the facts on the ground, is a phrase often used by both the Israelis and the Palestinians, to make it more and more difficult. I would actually say now close to impossible to have a viable Palestinian state. There's not a great deal left. The aquifers and the arable land have now been cut about in pieces, and what one is looking at is something that is likely to be always a client-dependent state if Palestine is actually born. But given the whole set of resolutions by the United Nations and all the rest of it, it is really quite difficult to simply toss the Palestinians away and say that there's no justice in what they're now claiming. I think that's an area where my own view is that the European Union ought to take a position which not necessarily has to be identical with that of Washington. Why do I say that? Because the European Union has, over the last 15, 20 years, paid for most of the Palestinian Authority, provided aid to Palestine, supported them in police reform and in literally food aid and things of that kind. In other words, Europe has paid but had almost no voice in the outcome. The United States has had the dominant voice in the outcome but is tied up so much with its own domestic politics that it can't act in a very independent manner. Those of you who know, as I do, the extraordinary influence of AIPAC in the United States politics, the American-Israeli Political Action Committee, will understand what I'm talking about. Now, I believe, and I'll put it very bluntly to you, my own view is that Israel will commit suicide if it doesn't find some way to deal with Palestinian ambitions which enables the state of Israel itself to be a majority Jewish state, which is what most Israeli governments have wanted. The alternative, the only alternative, if the idea of a separate state disappears, and I repeat, it's within, I think, a very, very short period of disappearing as an ambition and aspiration, would be to have a greater Israel, which would then, within a few years, probably have a majority of Arab citizens and will therefore vitiate and indeed wreck the concept of an independent Jewish state. And I believe that that is something really close to the heart, and rightly so, of many people in the Middle East. Well, that issue then brings me to the conclusion of what I want to say. The conclusion of what I want to say is that I think we are now in a situation where the European Union inescapably has to address the unattractive, nasty, bitter, sometimes vicious politics of the international world, where it can't simply disappear into excellent things like peacekeeping and peacemaking, because important as they are, and they are, there is this other set of issues out there which cannot be dealt with simply in that way. So my belief is that what we need is a more independent, more autonomous European Union foreign policy. But then we come to the final question at the end. Oh, such a policy requires there to be understanding and agreement on common policy positions. We are well able to adopt common policy positions about overseas aid, even about Copenhagen, though that won't be altogether easy. But when it comes to what have been the fundamental historic links between France and the world outside, Britain and the world outside, Germany is still very anxious not to be involved, it can possibly avoid it. What we need is a huge, intense debate in which the academic world must take a much more forward position and much greater interest than it currently does. It tends to walk by on the other side and address academic peculiarities rather than actually come to terms with this huge intellectual debate that we need, and we need soon. And I think that that debate ought to take us towards the idea of a common position where Europe can see the way ahead, even though that may mean the United Kingdom in particular having to swallow rather a lot of history. Thanks.